This is one of those days that we are all going to remember for a long, long time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, 6 January, and while it is always good to have you along, today it somehow feels different. You have seen the video, you have heard the audio. The United States Capitol building has been occupied by supporters of President Trump, spurred on by months of his lies about election fraud. We're going to talk about the economics of American politics right now, because after last night in Georgia, Democrats control the Senate and with it two of three branches of government. To start, though, Sudeep Reddy, one of our Friday regulars and a managing editor at Politico, on the news of this day. Hey, Sudeep.
Hey, Kai. Wild day, for sure.
Wild day. So super quickly, since this is a very gut and emotional day, what's your gut right now?
You know, it's been shocking to watch all of this, but also, sadly, it's not surprising. We've been all wondering for months, really for the last 4 years, whether something like this might happen. And now it did 2 weeks before inauguration. It's surreal to be on Capitol Hill listening to sirens for hours and hours. And then to just watch the Capitol building. I've walked those halls many thousands of times, and I was always struck by how intense security tends to be, and how intense security was this summer when there were other protests around D.C. And so to see this happen, it's just kind of mind-boggling to see it happen on a day that they should have been prepared for.
Yeah, for sure. Companies and CEOs have started to weigh in. Jamie Dimon from JPMorgan Chase and the Citibank CEO have said they deplore the violence and they want order restored. And then this afternoon, an amazing thing happened. The National Association of Manufacturers, a major lobbying group, a supporter early on of President Trump, issued a statement in which they called on Vice President Pence to assemble the cabinet and invoke the 25th Amendment, thus removing the president. Talk about that for a second, would you? Because that's just wild.
It is wild. And the words that Jay Timmons, the head of the group, used, he said what was happening is chaos, it's sedition. And he was calling out the people who might be anywhere willing to support it, even in the slightest sense. He's probably going to take some heat for it and have a backlash, but it does show how severe things have gotten. For a business group of this large to have this many business constituents to have to send a statement like this. Look, a functioning economy at its core rests on a normal functioning government and the basic rule of law. We've watched scenes over and over in barely functioning countries where people storm government buildings. Wonder like what on earth is going on? How are they going to have a functioning system? And it's obviously disturbing and embarrassing to see that happen in the United States. And it has pretty profound implications for the functioning of our country and the business of government that still has to go on.
Rule of law, we will get to in just a second. But I do have to point out here that Wall Street watched what was happening at the United States Capitol today and sent Dow and other indices to record highs. What?
It was wild, and you know, Wall Street reacts to things often late after waiting for a while, and we'll see. You could see a few ticks if you look at the charts when people had actually entered the Capitol building. You saw some gauges on in the stock market start to sell off. I imagine that there were people who were ready with their fingers on their keyboards to do something in that moment as they watched those scenes. But these were initially protests before it became the riots and mobs of people entering the Capitol. And so Wall Street has seen that many times before. It's just that I don't think anybody on Wall Street or in business has really grappled with what it means to see a national system that's broken to get to the point of this, where a president is encouraging his protesters to go and storm the Capitol building.
Also, has to be said, they were probably reacting, the markets were, to news out of Georgia and the idea that with Democrats now in charge of all three branches of the government, the odds of some more stimulus, not huge probably because it's a really tight Senate, but there will be more stimulus coming. What do you think?
Yeah, it was hard to find who the losers were on Wall Street. There were a few tech stocks that were selling off early, but not many. And it is true that having a 50-50 control with the vice president, 51, being able to pass stimulus. It does mean that you're not going to necessarily see a cliff in aid to people who are struggling. You're going to actually be able to get aid out through the economy over the course of the year, which is good for being able to defeat the virus and not have it wreck our economy, because the virus is getting worse in a lot of places. And that's the last stand that we have to get through to be able to move on. But there are all sorts of other things that are on the table now, infrastructure, other mm-hmm. kinds of programs. But there will be a different kind of reaction at some point when inflation fears start taking hold and treasury yields start surging again, as they often do in these cases.
God, you remember inflation? How about that? Sudeep Reddy at Politico, and with us today to talk about the events of this very, very sad and bizarre day. Sudeep, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai. Take care.
See you. We touched on it a little bit, me and Sudeep, but Wall Street went on its merry way today, threats to democracy notwithstanding. Sudeep set the scene for us, so now we are going to step back a little bit, get a feel for what the events of this day might mean for this country and this economy in the long term. Wendy Edelberg is the director of the Hamilton Project. She is also a senior fellow at Brookings. And we have talked a couple of times, she and I, about the 2020 election and the possibility of chaos. And, oh, look, here we are. Wendy, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. It's good to be here, though alarming under these circumstances.
Yeah, alarming is a good word for it. So this is not on the face of it, as Sudeep and I talked about a little bit, and you and I will. It's not on the face of it an economic story, right? But we have talked about people not accepting the results of this election and what might happen. What's going through your mind right now?
Yeah, so as Sudeep eloquently described, there are many horrible ramifications of what happened today at the Capitol. And yeah, as my expertise does not lie in democracies or electoral politics or insurrections, I will keep my comments to what I think it will do for the economy. Yeah. Instability and uncertainty are not good for the economy. And surely the Q1 forecast is very rightly not top of mind for most Americans this afternoon, with other concerns on their minds. And you're right, even though we haven't seen much in stock and bond markets, still, I think today's events will probably worsen the outlook. And that is so unfortunate and frustrating, given that the economy was already facing enormous challenges. Just this morning, I was seeing reasons for more optimism about the outlook for the next 6 months. And this is bad.
Well, so let's be clear here. You think this makes the chances or the odds of a longer, slower, rougher recovery more likely?
I do. All else equal, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, given this morning, I was focused on the results that we are seeing in Georgia, and that I thought if we, without divided government, I was thinking that we should be revising up our forecast for the year, that we could expect bolder and faster fiscal support, more energy behind keeping the pandemic under control, more support for state and local governments, extending unemployment insurance. I saw all sorts of reasons to have a little bit more optimism about the year ahead. And I was even thinking about what longer term problems Congress might be able to take on, even as it remained laser focused on the recovery. But now I think the highest priority that Congress has is restoring stability and creating certainty.
Okay, so let's take two slices of this. Number one, if you're a small business person in this economy and you're watching CNN or any of the cable news nets today and you see this happening, what are you thinking?
My guess is that you're pretty freaked out, and you're gonna sit and wait and see how things transpire. And it's not like things get resolved tomorrow.
Yeah.
This is going to take time to we're going to take time to heal from this as a country. I think you can't unring this bell. This happened, and it's going to take time for us to all learn to breathe normally again.
Same question, but for consumers. I'm going to guess you will tell me that consumers are likely to just sit tight and watch and see what happens.
I think consumers were already extraordinarily concerned about what they were seeing in the world. The pandemic is obviously surging. And we're seeing hiccups in the distribution of the vaccine. So I think consumers were already holding back on their spending, and we were already girding ourselves for a really challenging couple of months. And I would think that this just creates more headwinds when, gosh, that's just the last thing we needed.
Yeah, really challenging couple of months is not what anybody's in the mood for. Wendy Edelberg, the director of the Hamilton Project, also a senior fellow at Brookings. Wendy, thanks so much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
See ya. Lost a little bit in the news of the day, which I totally get, by the way, is that the virus is still in charge of this economy and that a whole lot of hope is hanging on Congress's latest relief package. A new Paycheck Protection Program was a big part of that package. Those forgivable loans meant mostly for small businesses. Details, though, of exactly how that program is going to work have been scarce until now. The Small Business Administration has started rolling out some new guidance, and Marketplace's Justin Ho has been talking to some of the people who are going to be making some of those loan applications about what kind of help they're looking for.
The new Paycheck Protection Program has more restrictions than the first one. It'll only be available to companies with fewer than 300 employees. The limit last time was 500. Phil McCollum, a tax partner with the accounting firm Henry & Horne, says many of his clients' headcounts have shifted over the past year, which raises questions.
You have to look at what the number of employees were last December, the fourth quarter of 2019, or can you just look at what's happening this quarter?
Applicants will also have to prove their businesses had a 25% revenue drop between the fourth quarter of 2020 and the fourth quarter of 2019. But many of the smallest businesses only keep yearly records, says Diane Sumter, who runs the South Carolina Minority Business Enterprise Center.
When I think of barbershops, when I think of hairdressers, I think of salons, they will never have those quarterly things because they don't keep up with it in that same vein.
Sumter says she's telling businesses to start preparing.
I'm trying to get something right as we speak out saying, get ready, get ready, get ready. At least have your documents that was required the first time.
But once the guidance is released, Peter Alden, CEO of the Bay State Savings Bank in Massachusetts, says there's a chance some customers won't qualify.
The last thing you want to do is to have a customer, you know, assume that they're eligible, give you all the information, then you got to say, guess what, you're not.
On the plus side, Alden says the bank's gone through this already, so this time the process should be more efficient. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
David Brancaccio and the gang on the morning show, the Marketplace Morning Report, will have the latest on the events of this day coming up tomorrow morning. Coming up.
The last email we got was, you know, this could change at any point.
Yeah, sums up today pretty well, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 437 points today, 1.4%, 30,829. The NASDAQ went the other way, 78 points to the bad, to the offside, to the loss. Take your pick. 0.6%, 12,740. S&P 500 found 21 points, 0.5%, 37.48. Working from home and remote work from anywhere have helped new home prices rise. That's especially true in smaller metropolitan areas like Cleveland, Boise, and Memphis. Today, real estate company Zillow fell 0.9%. The brokerage Redfin declined 0.7%. Today, Realogy, which owns Coldwell Banker, up 5.6%. Today, bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.03%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. As you just heard, Wall Street was mostly undisturbed today by the disturbing events in Washington. But the politics of this economy, as we said, changed last night with the Democratic wins in Georgia, a change most clearly indicated, in my humble opinion, by the bond market, the 10-year Treasury note, to be specific, and the yield on it, the interest rate it pays, which today hit a little tiny bit more than 1%. Minusculely small still, but the first time since March it has topped that mark. And reading the economic tea leaves, that might suggest more growth than we could have expected, oh, say, 24 hours ago. Benga Ajilore is a senior economist at the Center for American Progress. Benga, it's good to have you back on.
Thank you for having me.
So am I reading the tea leaves right that by going up, the yield on the 10-year is saying, hey, look, we're expecting some stimulus, bigger economic growth, and in some way a stronger recovery?
Well, I definitely think it's a safe bet that we're going to have a significant relief package once Biden's inaugurated. It's more of a question of how large as opposed to if or when.
Right. So let's get to that how large thing, because last time we had you on, you talked about a skinny relief package, right? That Congress was going to do something and then they were just going to leave it be, because at that point we thought Republicans were going to hold the Senate. That has now changed. Do you think the danger of a long, slow recovery has been abated a little bit?
I hope so, but I'm not confident. And one of the reasons why I'm not confident is that while the Democrats have control of the Senate, they don't have a filibuster-proof majority. So one of the things that I talked about before is that that skinny bill had a cap of $1 trillion. And so because of that, a lot of things were left on the cutting room floor. So something like state and local aid, paid leave, all these things now need to be added back in. But there might be some sort of difficulties in trying to get as much stuff that is needed for recovery.
One of the other things we talked about, you and I, was how the most impacted people by this recession from this pandemic have been lower income people and people of color. Do you anticipate any concentration on helping them, or is this just going to be a fire hose approach that Congress is going to, you know, cut $2,000 checks and then move on?
I think we will see more of a focus on people of color. And there are more women of color now in the House. We have Reverend Warnock, who's now going to be the first Black Democratic senator from the South. So having more people who understand the issues, that might push Congress and the administration to focus more on communities of color.
Yeah. Last thing, Begin, and then I'll let you go. If the Biden administration called you and said, what's the most impactful thing we could do with our 51-50 majority in the Senate with soon-to-be Vice President Harris, what would you tell him?
Well, I would say there's not one thing you could do, but I think just go big, because we have to worry about a rescue and then a recovery. But then most importantly, think about an inclusive recovery, and we can't do that by thinking small.
You know, it's so interesting. You're saying a rescue still. Here we are 9 months into this thing, and you as a trained economist are thinking we still need to rescue the American economy.
Well, just look at the numbers in the COVID. I mean, we have almost 350,000 people dead, 20 million. I mean, even where you are in Los Angeles, the ICUs are at 0% capacity. So we still need to rescue this economy before we can even think about recovery.
Benga Ajilore, senior economist at the Center for American Progress. Benga, thanks very much. I appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you for having me on again.
One of the things that isn't in the relief bill is help for state and local governments, which, as we have been telling you, have gotten squeezed by falling tax revenues and higher pandemic expenses. Tracy Gordon is a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. We talked to her maybe a month or so ago when the expected politics of this relief bill were somewhat different. Tracy, it is good to have you back.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Give me a sense, would you, of what, given the new landscape, right, of what a package for state and local governments might look like? What might Congress decide they want to spend money on?
Yeah, I mean, an aid package could take many different forms. You know, I think there have been various numbers that have floated around about how much money to direct to state and local governments. I think it's less important the total sticker price than the structure of the aid. For example, if you had a formula that triggered on when economic conditions warranted and off when they didn't, then you wouldn't have to worry so much about overspending, for example.
Yeah, but that, of course, assumes Congress would give us some authority to decide when it's going to issue those aid packages, which, as you and I both know, is a challenge. Last time we talked, one of the things you mentioned was that A lack of state and local relief would be a drag on the macro economy. Do you think, and look, this is all sort of reading tea leaves, as I said earlier, but do you think that problem has now gone away, that there's enough of a chance of relief that state and local governments and their budgets won't be a drag on the macro economy?
Well, everything depends on the shape of the recovery. You know, I think the actions that are taken for the larger economy are going to be very important for state and local governments as well. But we have seen state and local governments cut 1.3 million jobs already, yeah, or about 7% of their payrolls. So governors were preparing some tough budgets. Some states were actually seeing revenues come in higher than they expected. That in large part reflected the federal payments that had been received so far, and the improving economy. But, you know, the pace of the improvement is uncertain, and the continuation of federal aid is also uncertain.
Yeah, well, so to that pace of improvement, and then I'll get out of your hair. Do you think this relief can get out fast enough to avoid, if not more lasting damage to this economy, at least a hiccup in what has promised to be, you know, with the aid coming, you know, something of a relief effort?
That's a great question. You know, the checks have already gone out for the most part. Unrestricted relief can also get out quickly. So I don't think that the timeliness is an issue. I think pegging it to current conditions, figuring out where to get aid where it's most needed, right, is going to be more challenging.
Tracy Gordon, she's a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Tracy, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Thank you.
The new year, eventful as it has been so far, also means the start of a new semester for a lot of colleges and universities. Except maybe this year, because some of those schools have decided to again delay classes or move what would have been in person online. But another round of delayed starts and virtual learning is going to have both immediate and some long-term economic implications for those schools, as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
Mary Beth Gassman's daughter is a student at Bryn Mawr College. She was supposed to go back to school in mid-January, and now she's looking at mid-February.
They're definitely coming back on campus and staying in residence halls, but the last email we got was, you know, this could change at any point.
Gassman isn't only a college parent. She teaches at Rutgers and studies minority-serving institutions of higher education. She says schools are weighing health risks and their finances to make decisions.
If you don't have a safety net and you don't have a strong endowment and you are very, very tuition reliant, your situation is much, much more dire.
Dire because of reduced enrollment and unexpected costs. Millions of dollars spent on personal protective equipment and COVID-19 testing. Chris Marsicano is with the College Crisis Initiative at Davidson College.
A lot of institutions are heavily dependent on tuition and on room and board in order to keep their doors open.
School budgets are in worse shape now than they were last fall, says Robert Kelchin, a professor of higher education at Seton Hall.
But on the bright side, there's a clearer ending point to the pandemic than there was in the fall.
That's due to the vaccine. And Kelchin says schools have taken other steps, laying off staff, canceling majors, delaying entry to PhD programs, and pay cuts. Kelchin says his pay was cut by 7% in the spring. It's unclear when it'll be restored. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today on this terrible and embarrassing day for this country. The day after Election Day 2016, I told a story in this space on this program about a direct message that I'd gotten as it was becoming clear Donald Trump would be the next president. Sam was the guy's name, and he wanted to know why that had happened, why Donald Trump had been elected, and he wanted me to tell him basically that everything was going to be all right. And I did. I said that day after the election in 2016, I said everything was going to be okay in the long run. And I said it because I believed it. I had faith in our institutions. And then that night, after the show aired, I got another DM from Chris Hayes on MSNBC. Maybe you've heard of him. And Chris said, look, I respect your opinion, but this is going to be a catastrophe. And as we sit here a little bit more than 4 years later, Chris was obviously right, and I was obviously wrong, and I regret that, and we cannot ever forget what happened today. Okay, we're going. Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman engineer the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.